My castaway this week is a novelist. In her long life, she's in her late 80s, she's published more than 50 books, many of them set in India, where she lived for much of the first half of her life. They reflect her own experiences, clashes between parents and children, prejudice, sexual jealousy and poverty. Mm. Her most famous novel, Black Narcissus, was a huge success when it was published in 1939. It, like The River and The Greengage Summer, was turned into a popular film. One of her more recent works, The Peacock Spring, was dramatised on BBC One this year, and the latest is on her windowsill in Scotland, waiting to be sent to the publishers. Popular and enduring, rather than critically acclaimed, she once said that one of the advantages of never being fashionable is that you can never be out of fashion. She is Rumour Godden. And it's difficult to say you have ever been out of fashion, Rumour, because you've been permanently in print for years now,
yes,
haven't you?
Yes, and yes. There's one thing that I and my contemporaries wanted for our books. It wasn't money or success, though of course we wanted those. But it was for the books to last. And I have had, luckily for me, a little taste of that. Black Narcissus was written in 1938, and it has never been out of print in some part of the world since.
So that's, what, 48, 49, nearly 50 years?
Yeah, nearly 50 years.
But you haven't, as I said in that introduction, necessarily been critically acclaimed. For example, Margaret Drabble hasn't included you in her Companion to English Literature. Does that irritate you at all?
No, because I can quite understand it. They are what I would call cerebral writers. And I am only a storyteller.
They've called
I'm a deeply feeling one.
They've called you a sweet author.
Yes.
Do you object to that? Do you object to being called sweet?
Yes, because it's a lie. I'm not in the least sweet. You take Greengage Summer, a young girl who betrays her lover and hands him deliberately over to the police because she's piqued with him. That's not sweet.
What about The Peacock Spring, the
not
young
sweet at all.
English girl who becomes pregnant by the Indian boy?
Not at all sweet. Horrifying, no.
Why is it horrifying?
The details of inhumanity and prejudice and narrow-minded on the part of the British. It's really quite a political novel.
Tell me about your first record.
First record is from my latest film set in India. There have been other very beautiful ones, like The River, which I did with Renoir. And it's the last one. And like all Indian films, it has background music. I mean, I don't know how much you know about Indian music. But the great thing is that it's played over and over and over again. It goes on for hours, so that there's always a lot of background music. To me, very eloquent.
Theme music of the BBC adaptation of The Peacock Spring, and that music was composed by Dominic Muldowney. And The Peacock Spring was, of course, written by my castaway, Rumour Godden. Now, you were brought up, Rumour, during the First World War in India, you were a little girl of five, on the banks of a Bengali river because your father organised the river traffic and there were vast amounts of it. You always lived on the banks of the river.
Yeah.
Can you just give me a picture of that, the sight and the smell of that place?
Well, it was, I think, influenced one's whole life. People have no idea of the gigantic size of the rivers. Our particular river, the Meghna, was 2 miles from bank to bank. And something of that flow and calm and space, I think, influenced our childhood very much.
And yours, I think, was a rather grand house and household, wasn't it, that you lived in on the banks of this river, with chauffeurs and governesses?
Yes, but it was normal. I mean, people did there in India. But as a matter of fact, no governess would stay with us.
Why?
We were most unruly.
You were naughty
children. There were four of us, yes.
What did you do?
Well, we just lived our life to ourselves. And I'm always extremely grateful we didn't have sensible parents. Because in those days, in the hot weather, women and children were sent to the hills or back to Europe. Not my mother. She took us to a different part of India every year. And so we grew up, I think, knowing perhaps more of India than many Indians. But people would have said we were deprived because there were no schools, there were no libraries, there were no brownies or so forth that make up a child's world.
But you wrote forever, always.
And we had no books, we wrote our own.
How old were you when you began to write?
6.
And what did you write?
Novels.
About what?
Highly coloured. I also wrote my autobiography when I was 8, which was totally inaccurate. And my father laughed, roared at it. So and I said I'd never write again. But my father said it was a mercy. The house had so many waste paper baskets.
But you don't remember a time when you didn't write?
I can't remember a time when I didn't write. There was a flow that never stopped, and I think it came from those rivers.
Tell me about your second record.
It's a record which I've always loved very much because it's so simple. I mean, as played by Horowitz, it is of great beauty, and it's called, really, Dreaming. And it suited my childhood, absolutely, because half the time I wasn't there. I was in my own world.
Vladimir Horowitz playing Träumerei, part of Schumann's Kinderszenen, and yes. Opus 15. Mm. There seems to have been one blot on this otherwise idyllic childhood rumour, and that is that you were the ugly duckling of the four sisters.
Yes.
How much did that hurt?
Terribly. They were all very, very attractive.
And what did you look like?
I inherited the Hingley nose, and hadn't grown up to it as a child.
That's on your mother's side, is it?
Yes, on my mother's side. And I remember one day at lunch, and I know my father, he always joined us for lunch, and he looked down the table at me, and I know he didn't mean to be hurtful, he was just thinking aloud. And he said, "Where did that child get that face?" And it broke my heart. I went out and sobbed amongst the canna lilies that are so high that they hid you.
And it's, interestingly, it is almost a theme that crops up in your books. You're this child who lives in the shadow of the elder sister.
Like Gringoyle Summer.
Yes, yes. Mm. And indeed in the river, I think.
Yes.
And it's the elder sister who is elegant and lovely and often captures the hearts of the older men who come by. Is that what happened?
That is exactly what happened. After we'd been in England at school and left school and came back to India, I was very plump and very earnest. And every young man would flee at the sight of me, but she used to stand there in the ballroom and she'd say, "I'm sorry, I won't dance with you unless you dance with my sister."
But as you say, you came to this country to school after the First World War. Mm. You had a terrible time, you two girls together, your elder sister John, in a convent school. So that guaranteed that nuns at some point in your writing life were going to get a less than flattering appearance. But what is interesting is you went on to a school in Eastbourne, didn't you, and at last found somebody who recognised your writing.
Yes, it was the vice principal. She wasn't only a very good teacher, but she'd been a dramatist in her own right, and she worked with Michel Saint-Denis. And he said, "It's no use keeping you in classes. Would you like to come out and work alone with me?" Well, I worked for Mona for 2 years. I never wrote her a single story.
What did you do?
She taught me to write. I spent the first term producing the leader of the Times to 14 lines. I did comparing the consonants of Milton's Il Penseroso with those of L'Allegro to see how he got his effect of sadness and gaiety.
She also, I think, imposed on you the idea that you shouldn't have anything published until you were 25. Why did she do that?
Because, well, we see it ourselves. So many young start brilliantly and burn themselves out. A lot of the writing nowadays is very shoddy. Very shoddy, because they don't know.
They don't know what?
Grammar. They don't know grammar. They don't know feelings for words. They don't work with reference books and thesaurus.
So you believe, do you, there's always a right word and you will keep
thinking until
you find that word?
I always remember a quotation of T.S. Eliot's. And he said you were writing a poem and you were committed to it. And you spent the whole of a day trying a word on the poem. And every time the poem said, "No, not that," which I always think is a lovely thing to say.
So there's always a right word.
There's always a right word, but you have to find it. And you've got to listen. They don't listen.
Tell me about your third record.
Well, as a relief from all this concentrated literary work, I turned to my number two, love. I mean, I haven't the talent for it, but I turned to it and became a dancer. It was the ballroom dancing that was so lovely in those days. You had none of the jumping up and down and the jigging and the beating up. It was very smooth and very, very clever. And there was a thing called bodyline. If you were dancing, say, a slow foxtrot, between the couple's bodies, no chink of light should have been seen. You were absolutely together like that. And your head was high and your hands were absolutely still. And you glided. The steps were so smooth. It was as beautiful to watch as it was to dance. Thank you.
Stormy Weather from Duke Ellington and his famous orchestra, capital F, capital O. You were, Rumour Garden, it seems to me, perhaps still are, a rebel all the way through, weren't you? You've always disliked rules and formality per se. In fact, you really adopted rather a racy lifestyle in Calcutta in your 20s, didn't you? Broke a lot of rules.
Yes, I broke a lot of rules. One of the things I did was to open a school of dancing. And no girl or young woman in Calcutta society with any kind of name earned their living. It was understood they didn't do it.
Nice girls didn't do it.
Nice, yes. Exactly.
But you
nice
were a bad girls girl.
Didn't. You were a bad girl. And particularly dancing. Most dancing schools in India were brothels.
But you had fun. You loved it. You were doing what you wanted to do.
Yes.
And social life was good. You weren't ostracised as a result, were you?
No, I was. Terribly.
Were you?
Oh, yes. And I got very indignant about the Eurasian girls because Calcutta had A girls and B girls. A girls went away in the hills or back to Europe or wherever. And then the young men were allowed to take the B girls to the clubs. But if you met a young man you knew and he was with a B girl, you had to cut him. Otherwise it was embarrassing for him.
And that was presumably eventually why you wrote your second novel, The Lady and the Unicorn.
And I was moved to write my second novel. And I did what my husband very much disapproved of. I used to go wandering in those streets on foot.
But just going back to before you were married, because the point here is, isn't it, that that you had to get married because you found yourself pregnant.
Yes.
Do you mind if I just ask you about that? Was it a terrible, terrible disgrace when you found you were pregnant?
Well, I absolutely refused, which the doctors wanted to do, and my husband wanted to do, take the baby away.
To abort? Was that possible then?
Yes, if you paid.
Is that what nice girls did?
And I absolutely refused. This was my baby. My first husband, who was a very charming man, said, well, you have to marry me and pretend you like it. He knew you were not of a kind.
And, of course, the sad fact is that you lost that baby, didn't you?
Yes, 2 days. And found myself with a marriage that was incompatible. And also, he was a stockbroker. And he had gambled on the stock exchange and was deeply, deeply in debt.
And by this time you had 2 small daughters.
I had 2 small daughters. And I found myself completely impoverished and rather ill in Kashmir.
Tell me about your 4th record.
Yes. You can imagine what it is like. After 5 years in that isolated little Kashmiri house, I saw no Europeans. Suddenly to come back to England and be plunged into London life, and not only London life, but London literary life. And it was like a sort of whirligig around me. And then mysteriously, I sort of found a purpose. I had a sort of call, and I became a Catholic in the midst of that, and found great peace. And the next piece of music, you will hear the universal aspect of the Roman Catholic Church. Cordero de Dios que quita los pecados del mundo, ten compasión de nosotros.
part of the Agnus Dei from Ariel Ramirez's Missa Criolla, performed by Los Fronterizos and the choir of the Cocoro Basilica, conducted by Father J.G. Segardo. You've said of your book, The River, Rumour, the river is one of those rare books that are given to you. What was different about that? What does that mean?
A book is vouchsafed to you when it suddenly descends, that's all you can call it. And at the end of the war, when I came back to Calcutta, I was asked by the women's volunteers to tour a province of India, because Lord Boyne has raised questions in Parliament about the role that British and American women were playing in the war. And so I went on my tour, which took me back to Dhaka. Usually the steamer would leave the ghat and turn round and go upstream. And this steamer backed and backed and backed and backed and backed. So it was like looking through the long end of a telescope. And it got smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. And the little temples and the burning ghats and the steps and everything became minuscule. And instead of going to my cabin and writing my report, I went to the cabin and wrote The River.
And that coincided with your life being at a pretty low ebb, didn't it?
At a very low ebb. When I came back to England, because of the troubles in Kashmir, as you know, I got into trouble with Kashmir with a servant who attempted to poison me. And I had to leave everything.
And when you arrived back in this country, you had the manuscript of The River in
and
your bag.
Just a few things I had. I had a suitcase with a few clothes in it for the children. I had a Persian rug, which my Kashmiri friend, disgraceful man, induced me to buy because he said it would be for a rainy day. And in my suitcase, I had the manuscript of The River. So we could start again.
Would you say, Rumour, that your writing has been the most important thing in your life? Perhaps even on occasions, what I'm saying is more important than your children?
I don't think you can assess it like that. You're born one. You weren't born to have children. You had children. You weren't born to get married, though in the normal course of affairs, you do get married. But if you have a gift, painting, music, writing, it's not a question of loving one more than the other or more important than the other. I mean, I always say, it's a gift.
But it's not a gift that you can ignore.
No.
It is something that demands your attention.
It demands your attention.
All of the time.
Yes. And you have to discipline yourself to live an ordinary life with it if you're going to have children and things.
Tell me about your fifth record, Rumour.
Well, the Berlioz, I love very much because my life has been one of extraordinary changes. And I don't know any other piece of music so packed with different styles of music, which I always love. You never come to the end of surprise.
part of Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique, played by the Philadelphia Orchestra, conducted by Eugene Ormandy. Mm. You've written children's books too, Rumour, the prize-winning Didikoi, The Mousewife and The Doll's House. How great a difference is there in writing for children as opposed to adults?
A great deal of difference. I try and write a children's book between every novel, simply because of the discipline. You know, people write letters to me and say, I thought I'd start with something easy. That's writing a children's book. Well, it's the most difficult form of writing next to poetry. And the younger the child, the more difficult it is.
Why? Because you've got to hold them at every moment.
Yes, you've got to hold every moment. You have got to choose your words. I mean, not basic English or anything like that, but choose words that convey and add to the few words you have, because you have very much fewer words. And also, you can't have a lot of description. Very boring description.
But at the same time, you can't patronise children, can you?
Oh,
They're very discerning.
Never. And they're your best critics, because they say what they think.
Mm-hmm. What you don't do, as I understand it, is accept an advance for a book, the money up front. Why don't you do that? Every other writer does.
I would do it on a biography, because you know it's going to be published. But if you do it on an... I don't like using that, to me, presumptuous word, creative, but imaginative work. Directly you accept money, you put yourself into a straitjacket. And I see these young people, it's common practice nowadays, they have an idea. And they have to write a synopsis of the first chapter, or show the first chapter. And the editors commission it, or not commission it, on that. Well, having it done on your first chapter, that's nearly always the one you want to throw away. And if you have a synopsis, sure as eggs are eggs, is your book's going to turn out differently.
I see what you mean about a straitjacket.
You just
are unable to allow the thing to develop naturally.
Yes. And you can't pay it back because you probably spent it. So you have to write the kind of book you don't want to write.
Tell me about record number 6.
Well, it just is that all music, to me, the human voice is the most wonderful. And one of my very favourite songs, and I know it's one of the most difficult, is the Countess's Aria from Figaro. In the midst of all the fun, you have this beautiful and absolutely plaintive aria.
Countess's song, Porgy Amor, from Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro, sung by Elisabeth Schwarzkopf, accompanied by the Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by Carlo Maria Giulini. I suspect, Rumour, that the solitariness of a desert island would suit you, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would. I mean, I need so much time to myself, and I can never have enough time.
Because of the writing?
Because of the writing.
Because of the need to write and
yes.
to go on and on.
And need to write and need for my spiritual purposes.
What you self-evidently are not is an elderly lady who's been a sweet novelist in her time, as we were talking about at the beginning.
Not at all.
What adjective would you like applied to you? What do you feel it would be a fitting epitaph? Certainly not sweet, as we've said. Determined?
Mm-hmm.
Or accomplished? What do you like for yourself?
It's very difficult to say so without being conceited.
Well, we allow a little conceit.
I think distinguished. Distinguished, because distinguished just doesn't mean high up. It means you're different from everybody else. And I think I feel that. I mean, my reactions are very often so totally different that they puzzle people.
Hmm. Tell me about your seventh record.
The Little Prelude. Everybody knows it. It's an absolute cliché. But I love it very much because it allies my love of music and dancing. Because that little piece of music dances by itself without even a dancer.
Part of Chopin's Les Sylphides, played by the Ballet Theatre Orchestra, conducted by Joseph Levin. Mm. So you'll dance on the sand, Ruma, on this desert island, and think up your next story.
Yeah.
Your current next novel, as I said at the beginning, is On Your Window Ledge in Scotland.
Yes.
What's the process? How many readings or rewritings does it go through before you finally submit it?
That entirely depends on the book. I vary from one that took me 8 years. Or one might write itself in about 5 months. This one has taken 2 years, and I couldn't tell you why.
Everything that you write, Ruma, has a seed somewhere in your life, in your experience.
Yes, a little grit, I call it, a little seed of experience.
And what happens to that little bit of grit?
For some reason, and again, we're back to the mystery, it secretes itself in your mind. And then it gathers around it all the rest of its stories. What you mustn't do is impose a story on it. You let it find its own story.
So it's like an oyster secreting
its
own pearl.
It's really like an oyster, and of course the result is very seldom a pearl. But it is very like an oyster.
And you're 89 later this year, and you haven't run out of little seeds irritating away there yet, have you?
Well, temporarily, I'd like a little rest.
But do you think you'd ever give up writing?
No. You don't give up writing if you're a born writer until writing gives you up. There will come a time to me when I will have writer's block, and I can't write anymore.
But you haven't had it for 84 years since you began at the age of...
Yes, but it might happen any minute. I always say, when I feel now it really is time, I say, God says this to me, come along, it's time you went off. And I say, well, just let me finish this novel first, and then we'll have a see. And he usually does.
Last record.
Well, this is a piece of music that I love very much. And I play it usually at night when I'm worried, when I am near despair. I mean, people think writing is a peaceful occupation. It's anything but. You write up there and then you write down there. When you get your periods of utter down and you know you're not going to sleep and you're good, it's going to be difficult. I play this.
Claudio Arrow playing Benediction de Dieu dans la Solitude by Franz Liszt. If you could only take one of those eight records, Rumour, which one do you think it would be?
Possibly Dreaming.
Memories of your childhood.
Mm.
What about your book? You've got, as you know, the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare.
Yes. I would take Edith Sitwell's Book of Atlantic Poetry, because it has American and French as well as English.
And what about your luxury?
Well, I hesitated about this. I would like to take A Widow's Cruise. Most people don't know what a cruise is, but it's like a earthenware bread bin with a lid. And in biblical days, there was a great famine, and the prophet Elijah was starving. And he met a widow carrying a cruse and asked her to make him a little cake. And she said, I can't, because I've only got a handful of flour and a spoon of oil, and that's for my little son and me. But all the same, she made him the cake. And then she lamented, now my cruse is empty. And Elijah said, it will never be empty again as long as you live. It'll be always filled to the brim. So I want a widow's cruse, and it'll be filled to the brim. But not with flour and oil. Mine will be filled with whiskey.
Rumour Garden, thank you very much indeed.